Welcome to The Sound of Economics, the podcast series of Bruegel, the Brussels-based economic think tank. Today, we have a special episode on the 30 years anniversary of the Maastricht Treaty. And for that, we have teamed up with Studio Europa Maastricht, which is a center of expertise for Europe-related debates and research. In our discussion today, we will go back to how we remember 1992, the year the treaty was signed. We will ask what it aimed to achieve, what it actually achieved, and where do we go from here? I'm Maria Demergis, and joining me today are Amy Verdun, who is a professor of political science at the University of Victoria and currently a visiting professor at Leiden University. Hi, Amy. Thank you for joining us.
Hi, Maria.
And Mathieu Segers, who is a professor in contemporary European history at Maastricht University and Europe chair at Studio Europa Maastricht. Welcome, Mathieu.
Hi, Maria. Very happy to participate in this.
And wonderful, actually, for co-hosting this podcast for us. Thank you for that. It is a special episode, actually, today, where we go back to remember the Maastricht Treaty. 2022 is the year where we complete 30 years from the signing of it. And by means of starting the conversation, how do you remember that year? I can tell you, I was a PhD student at the time, very much working on issues that had to do with the objective of the Maastricht Treaty. And I was very, very encouraged by what it aimed to achieve. Amy.
Yeah, so it's funny you should say that you were a PhD student because I was a PhD student myself as well. In fact, I had an internship with the European Commission in what was called DG2. Today, we would call that Economic and Financial Affairs in Brussels. And I was in the Berlaymont building that was about to be vacated because they had to take asbestos out. So it was a very memorable moment for me personally. But I think if you ask us the question about what we remember of that period, I would say that it was a combination of a lot of things coming together. So I would say the signing corresponded with a revamping of Europe, the idea that Europe was going to go into a new period. And it wasn't only because of the internal things in the EU, but also because of external things like the fall of the Berlin Wall and the collapse of the Soviet Union. So I think it was really a watershed moment in European history.
Mathieu, how do you remember 92?
Yeah, I'm a bit younger. I was a 15-year-old boy then, focused on football mainly. But I was born and raised in Maastricht. So I lived actually in the streets where the figureheads and the stars of European politics were walking around. Because I was interested in international politics then already a bit, next to football, I tried to come close to these stars of the European politics of that time, like François Mitterrand. Helmut Kohl was actually in a hotel that was only a half kilometer away from my house. So international politics literally landed at my doorstep in the city center of Maastricht. So that is what I remember personally. But I also remember, and I think with hindsight a bit, but also at that moment, I was very aware of the fact that this was as Amy said, a watershed moment in international and European politics. And I think somebody who really captured what was going on then is Federica Mogherini, who spoke on the occasion of the 25th anniversary of the Maastricht Treaty, so 5 years ago. And she said the Maastricht Treaty was a revolution. For the first time in the history of the world, building peace became the aspiration of an entire continent. And I think that encapsulated the promise of the Treaty of Maastricht. But of course, we are still, you know, awaiting to see that promise crystallize clearly for every European. But I think at that moment, there was high hopes, as you also said, Maria.
Well, high hopes indeed, but there have been other treaties and there will be more treaties. And subsequently after the signing of Maastricht, well, there were other treaties. But maybe do you agree that this was actually a very significant treaty in the context of the European edifice?
I think it was a very significant treaty. We're currently working on a Canadian textbook for students to give a very basic introduction to the European Union. And the number of times that we refer back to this particular treaty in every single policy area is really quite astounding. Sometimes when we think about the European Union and treaty change, We think that after Maastricht, we had so many more moments where we tried to change the treaty as if Maastricht was not really complete. But I think that kind of takes away from the shine of Maastricht. It was the big first major treaty change, and it did settle a lot of things. So we had suddenly a number of policy areas that really haven't been what the EU does put into the treaty, even like tidbits and kernels that would be later worked out in subsequent treaties. And it was an area in which the EU became really sort of a joint entity with member states. And don't forget, we got an expansion to the European Parliament. There was more of the legislative process that could be done with co-decision, right? Another element that we saw in the Maastricht Treaty. And I think it set also this hope for like an ever closer union. So I think Maastricht in many ways was really that that major treaty that jump-started, after all, the European Union in the way in which we use the language since that 1st of November 1993, when the treaty entered into force.
Let's then try and unravel that a little bit. What did the Maastricht then aim to achieve? What were the areas where major advancements were made, in your view, Mathieu?
Building on what Amy already said, first of all, it's very important, I think, to recognize that the Maastricht Treaty was indeed that watershed moment, because the Europe of European integration was moving from the order of Rome, the Rome treaties, very much focused on the market and market integration alone, the completion of that major project, was moving from the order of Rome to the order of Maastricht, which was European integration that reached beyond these boundaries of market integration into the political sphere. So more about the positioning of, for instance, the European Union that then came into being through the Maastricht Treaty. Before that, it was the European Community, of course. It became the European Union. One of the main goals was to position this Europe of European integration in an international politics that was revolutionized by the fall of the Berlin Wall, the coming of the end of the Cold War, obviously, the implosion of the Soviet Union somewhat later. And the Europe had to position itself in that new post-Cold War world order. And that was, in essence, what drove the Maastricht Treaty and also drove the politicians then negotiating and signing that treaty to go beyond the market project into the political realm. And we see that, for instance, in the ambition to have a common security and defense policy, which was the second pillar of the Treaty of Maastricht. The first was the internal market. Security and defense was the second. And the third was internal affairs and justice. And in that third pillar, we also see this ambition to become a more political project. For instance, a project like European citizenship, which we have since the Treaty of Maastricht. So this political dimension is, I think, key to understand what happened in this transformation through the Maastricht Treaty from the order of Rome to the order of Maastricht.
That's a wonderful way of putting it. I mean, let's go a little bit more in detail about the things that the Maastricht actually did achieve. Very often we think about Maastricht and we identify Maastricht with what it did in economic terms, or perhaps what it didn't do in economic terms, but always in economic terms. But there's so much more to it. And, you know, when we look at it now and try and evaluate, what did it do well and where were the ambitions met? And where were the ambitions really not met because they're not achievable or because the political capital wasn't there? Let's just try and decipher all of this. What aspects of the Maastricht Treaty we made huge advancements in the subsequent 30 years, and now they're gone, of course, but the years that followed, where did we make the most advantage of the things that were set out in the Maastricht Treaty? Let's start with you, Amy.
Yeah, so I think what Mathieu has been indicating in his previous response was that the EU did quite a number of things in terms of major agenda setting, but also reforming some of the more legal bases of the European Union. So he mentioned how we moved from the community to the union. But if you were a lawyer, you were still talking about the community. And that is very confusing for students and day-to-day citizens, because like major newspapers went over to talking about the European Union. And then if you looked at treaties and the legal text, it still referred to the community. And I think that is ultimately, because we moved into what we called this sort of first pillar of Maastricht, which integrated all of the legal communities that had come before. So not only the European Economic Community that we spoke about already, but also the European Coal and Steel Community, the European Atomic Energy Community. And it set up a way of governance in that first pillar that really was beyond the member states. You could be voted away. There was the role of the legislative actors, council and parliament and commission. So it started to look like a mini federal state in that domain. Now, in the other two pillars, where not everybody was equally excited to make that amount of change, we left it to a more consensus-based decision-making process. So every member state could say, I don't think so, or maybe not yet. And so in those areas that already Mathieu touched upon, in the area of common foreign and security policy, but also in the area of justice, home affairs, police cooperation, migration, citizenship, the member states were really still doing their own thing. And it would take many years for a number of these policy areas to move over from that consensus mode into the way in which policies are made in this first pillar, so that we have a sort of a pseudo-federalist arrangement in quite a number of policymaking areas. So I would argue that in those steps, a huge progress was being made towards these step-by-step giving more competence to the EU and moving it away from member states, but with the advantage you could actually make some policies, make some laws, and advance.
But can I ask you, Amy, because I think that's, of course, that's all very good, but how did the citizens experience Maastricht? Any citizen in the European Union who is not a student of the Maastricht, legal or otherwise, how did Maastricht make a difference to their lives?
Yeah, so as mentioned, they were for the first time EU citizens, right? So they became in name an EU citizen. In fact, for the citizen, that was very confusing because nothing changed at all. Over time, the countries would change the visuals of the passports to look similar. So now everybody was waving red passports around instead of what it was before. And people were told they were a citizen of the EU, which really meant that if you were a citizen of a member state, you were by definition a citizen of the European Union. But the European Union was clever and said, okay, what could citizens feel about being a citizen of the EU? Well, they were allowed, of course, to move freely. They could go to any country in the EU and be there, no problem. They could work in another member state, and they could also get some of the services that come from being a citizen of a member state. And the court had to help a little bit. So I remember tourists being able, for the first time, to use their national healthcare in another country. And that was the logical consequence of being a citizen of the EU, having free movement, and the court saying you should be able to have the rights of your own healthcare in another country when you're traveling. So these are just a couple of examples of how that citizenship actually materialized in the post-Maastricht period.
And of course, we will see it, you know, many years later in 2016, when this European citizenship was taken away from citizens. And I'm thinking, of course, here of the UK and Brexit, how much this idea resonated with us. Mathieu, do you share Amy's views?
Yes, absolutely. But I think it's also important to take one step back and then look at this moment of passage, as I called it, from the Order of Rome to the Order of Maastricht. It was a remarkable moment in many aspects, but one of the key things that ordinary Europeans experienced was estrangement. It was not a connection to this revolutionary move that Federica Mogherini rightly defined as such, I think, from her perspective. Why was this estrangement also so prominent? Estrangement from Europe. Estrangement from the Europe of European integration that once was Western Europe and now was clear that it would become something else already at that moment. I think it's very important here to see that that moment of the Maastricht Treaty was a very political moment, as I said already, actually a very geopolitical moment. Europe had to position itself in a post-Cold War international order. At the same time, the Maastricht Treaty, so the answer of the European cooperating member states, was not political, but very technocratic. So in the end, if you look to the projects that really were fleshed out in Maastricht, it was especially, for instance, economic and monetary union. And that project was very much traditional, technocratic European integration practices. So very technocratic project that was understood by the general public, but not felt as something that was an adequate answer to the challenges of that moment, which were very geopolitical. So there you have a kind of a source of estrangement already for ordinary Europeans, seeing that there was an ultimate geopolitical moment going on, and that the answer that we came up with was very technocratic. I think for us specialists and experts, there is a logic in that answer. And to a certain extent, it was an adequate answer, because at the bottom line of the answer was, we will go together into this new phase of post-Cold War international relations. That is something that we want to face together, the challenges that will confront us in that new era. That bottom line was very political, but it was not that visible for ordinary Europeans. And then when it further was developed in the next years, it became a very technocratic undertaking, focused on economic and monetary union, which was far away from the political sentiments felt in European societies.
It may be that the immediate reaction of the European citizen, wasn't as big as perhaps the meaning of Maastricht Treaty itself would imply. Yeah. But, think of what Amy just said about the passports, right? The moment you held a European passport, didn't that immediately, reduce a little bit of that estrangement, maybe initial estrangement, or you don't think that it was as significant?
No, I'm not sure. So there was a lot of skepsis. There was demonstrations, protests in the streets of Maastricht. There was enormous security measures, unknown to a provincial town like Maastricht, because there was threats of, riots. There were farmers with very violent protests in the streets. There was a coverage in the news which was seeking a narrative to explain what was going on to a broader public, but not finding that narrative. So it was very superficial in the end, what came to the general media and to the ordinary Europeans. And of course, there were these concrete results that you point at, but these were taken more or less as something that came naturally from the internal market, not from a political project. And I think that is a big problem, because the political dimension of Maastricht was never felt. It was not in the heart and minds of most Europeans, I think. So it remained a technocratic project quite far away from the day-to-day lives of ordinary Europeans.
And yet, I think we all agree that the political impetus that Maastricht brought was enormous, because some of the things that eventually happened, namely, I'm thinking here of the euro, for example, which was created very much with the Maastricht Treaty, the basis for the Maastricht Treaty, is a project that couldn't have survived without the political backup. Technocratic backup would not have sufficed. And yet, Maastricht was all about the politics. But it's an interesting point that you raised.
Yeah, we understand this, Maria. We understand because we studied it. But the strange thing remains that it was a very, very political move, which was not understood by ordinary Europeans as a political move. And that remains a paradox.
That's right. Well, anyway, let's look, 30 years have passed, and I think now we all understand that this is a political project and, many things have happened to then. If I were to pick on two things where I think Maastricht made a huge difference successfully, that was very much the free movement of all the factors of production, what we call economics, capital, labor, and goods. That was very much back then. And of course, the movement of citizens in all aspects of the world to work and live elsewhere without having to ask for any permission to anybody. And then, of course, the euro, because the euro, also with the benefit of the hindsight, has been of enormous welfare significance. And we can discuss whether it's good welfare or bad welfare, but it has changed the welfare of the Europeans as a project in itself. Amy, what would be the two things, if you were to pick two things from the Maastricht that were done successfully with a view of integrating Europe further, and we can discuss this a little bit more in detail, what would that be?
Yeah, so I think the more federalist aspirations of Europe were really cemented at Maastricht. So I mentioned already the co-decision procedure, the role of the European Parliament, and these aspirations of setting up the political edifice a little bit better. I think in response to what Mathieu said, a lot of citizens who didn't like what they were seeing, that were not very many citizens, and very outspoken citizens. We see this now also with the COVID we have today. Outspoken people can make a lot of noise with very few people and going to very strategic places. That doesn't mean they represent everybody. But it means that if you don't quite get it, then you don't exactly know where to go. And in the EU context, the European Parliament had really lagged behind because it wasn't a federation. It was an international organization. And so it took a lot of time, step by step, to build the democratic credentials of Europe. And it starts by also giving power away. And that's very difficult. If you don't identify with something, why would you give political power away? And so if you're an aspiring politician, why would you sit in the European Parliament? No, if you were done national politics and you wanted a good political life, you could go to the European Parliament, right? But are young, ambitious politicians going to go and sit in the European Parliament when it has no power? So it takes that sort of leap of faith. We're going to give it power. Then we'll get the right politicians. And then it will be an aspiring place to be. And you want to go to the European Parliament and say, I want these roaming charges to go down. I want us to have a better voice against sort of Monsanto's, you know, artificially manipulated Roundup and stuff like that. So we get citizens actually needing to also be guided to create a sense of European identity that doesn't come from the sky, right? So I think that's one important step that happened during the Maastricht Treaty and the Maastricht period. And I think the other one I would know in terms of my own background with the single currency is what you also highlighted. So the idea of having a concrete symbol of Europe, having the markets, having the money, having something that unites the European Union. Obviously, this is difficult to identify with. People don't passionately identify with a money, right? So speak to people who came out of, let's say, Slovenia, right? Yugoslavia fell apart, and then they had to kind of make that next step, right? So some of them, like Slovenia, joined the European Union fast, and it also joined the currency fast. And why not hold on to these symbols of national identity? But to some extent, people are pragmatic, right? You want to know that your currency is strong, that you can go to places, and that it will serve you well. Economists will do the calculation, right? They will look at sort of cost and benefits, the advantages of trade, and so on. But it's difficult for citizens to fully understand these advantages. But they do understand when they can move freely. So the Schengen Agreement that was created before Maastricht, but was also taken along in the Maastricht construction, and being able to take your money and go everywhere. So I think those were really important developments that came out of Maastricht.
And Mathieu, before I ask the next question, if you can give me two things that you believe that Maastricht did very well.
Yeah, I think Amy said a lot of things that I want to react to. So first of all, I think she's very right about this identity building that kicked in with Maastricht. And you can see that, for instance, in the generation of students that I have now. They know no other Europe than the Europe of the Euro, for instance. And that is a sign that a new collective memory is building. But this collective memory is very young still. So it's only a few decades old. If you compare that to the collective memory connected to nation states, for instance, this is a very vulnerable collective memory still. This is very much in its infancy, the collective memory that is really trans-European. But it's reflected by younger generations already. And that is in itself a hopeful and also a necessary sign for us to carry on in the project. So that is a general comment that I would like to make. Then your question, the two things connected to the Treaty of Maastricht that are key, I think we didn't mention yet, but which is maybe the most essential thing that was connected to the Maastricht Treaty, is the German unification. It was more or less common agreement in Europe that it was a necessary thing to strengthen European integration as the flip side of accepting a German unification at the pace that we did in Western Europe. So I think that is very important to have that historical element also mentioned today. And next to that, the most important achievements of Maastricht for me are the euro, as you already said, and we can go deeper into that in the next couple of minutes, in connection with the free movement of capital. And that is something that we underestimated at that moment, the power of the free movement of capital that was created through the Maastricht Treaty. Because before the Maastricht Treaty, we had still capital controls. We still had a big internal market when it came to capital and financial services and banking, for instance. That really carried the next stage of market integration that we entered in Maastricht, without really knowing what we entered, because the shock, of course, of this free movement of capital and the impossibility to manage it with the existing instruments, this interdependence of financial markets, was, of course, clear when the euro crisis broke out in 2009. But then it was already too late to really proactively manage that interdependence of the free movement of capital. And I think that is a key thing set in motion by the Maastricht Treaty.
Well, I think you're absolutely right. And in fact, let's zoom in a little bit on the euro, because it will become of great relevance in the years to follow, both in its successes, but also in its failures. And it will be important to understand what, you know, and if I slowly move now into the next part of our conversation, what did Maastricht not do quite so well? I think if we zoom in a little bit on the economics of it, the euro itself, the currency, the reasons why we adopted the currency, what did countries aim to achieve with the euro? Did everybody adopt the euro for the same reason? And, you know, there's still some countries that refuse to adopt the euro, part of the EU, even though the treaty in principle wants everybody to become members of the euro. And of course, the subsequent problems that came as a result of not having a fully economic union, but a partial economic union. So let's go back and identify the institutions that were created with Maastricht, the currency itself, the European Central Bank as the guardian of the currency and the institution that will actually handle that, monetary policy, in other words. We had also, here Maastricht has been very, very important, is the fiscal coordination that countries required, the famous Maastricht rules, of course, that are very topical this year. We can discuss this a little bit further down. These are elements of architecture of building up an economic union that were important for the economic puzzle, but they didn't go possibly as far. Let's talk about this and see what was done well and what was not done quite so well in building up the economics of monetary union. Amy, your view on this?
Yeah, so maybe just two words on what Mathieu was saying about freedom of capital as well. So partially that was already in the spirit prior, but it took until July 1990 for capital movement actually to become free. And it was part of the so-called Delors Report to create a path towards monetary union in stages. And interestingly, as much as German reunification was absolutely underpinning a lot of what was happening in that turn of the sort of turn of the decade in 1989, 1990, it was also very mixed. So the Delors Report that set up the blueprint for economic and monetary union was signed in April 1989. So the wall comes down in 1989 in November. And we're not sure yet in April that this is the case, right? So there is these parallel worlds that are happening. And it wasn't formally that German reunification was permitted and that therefore the German Bundesbank would be the model for the European Central Bank. These things were happening at the same time. And it's fascinating to see how sometimes things are just happening at once. Now, obviously, you need political agreement and you need trade-offs and you need people to come together. And in that big mix, we see this sort of like, okay, you'll get this, we'll get that, you need to do the following. And coming back to your question, Maria, about what did not go so well. I mean, one of the things that was really astoundingly difficult was how to deal with the United Kingdom. So we have at the negotiating table, we have the Germans, the French, the Brits, they're all trying to build this Europe of the future. And Margaret Thatcher is very keen to have a single market and have free movement of labor, free movement of all of these elements of our market that will make it possible for the United Kingdom to thrive. But they're not so keen on this transfer of sovereignty over money to anybody but themselves. And so they remembered the 1960s and they remembered how difficult it was not to be part of the table that decides the rules. So already from the very beginning, they have not signed off on the idea of EMU. In fact, they're against, but they don't want to not be there. So the entire period, there's a big negotiation. And then at the very end, they decide, okay, well, let's have the Brits have an opt-out. So they don't have to do this. They opt out of the single currency. They opt out of social chapter. And then they will, you know, we'll see what happens next, right? So the whole differentiation process where they have the Europe à la carte, which was being discussed at Maastricht and dismissed, we're not doing this, in fact happens by having this opt-out. First for the Brits, but then the Danes are offered the same in case they don't want to do the single currency, which in fact their referendum also doesn't want. And as Mathieu was saying, we have this disconnect between some who like it and some who don't like it. And as the master treaty has to be implemented, the French, they vote with the smallest possible margin to agree to the master treaty. So we have at this important intersection, indeed, a number of these other elements that come to the fore of not quite sure how to do it. So what are some of these big achievements that we do have? I think that what we do right in the single currency era is to move with the things that the people can understand. So the EMU was created with a central bank that was modeled after a successful central bank that had in practice led the EU. So that was the Bundesbank. A lot of central banks had been following the policies of the Bundesbank very quickly, right after this, the central bank in Germany would set its interest rates, the other member states would follow very quickly. But there was no clear understanding of what model there should be for fiscal policy. So the setting of either taxes or deciding how much money there should be redistributed between taxing and spending. So all of this was kept in the domain of member states, and then leading with benchmarks and best practices and rules to manage that whole process. So the agreement was to do what they knew well and to just let the other things emerge as whether they would be necessary or what next steps. And that was important because you would need also that legitimacy. If you had a philosopher king coming up with a brilliant idea, we're going to do it this way, then the citizens would never feel that they could understand. And again, with the COVID crisis, we see this continuously. There's expertise, but there's also this dance with the citizens and with the companies. And exactly what are you doing? And is it in the interest of everybody? And do people like it or not? So this dance in terms of who's responsible and what is technocratically reasonable to do.
I like your criteria of advance with things that people can understand. I think that's kind of interesting because I think it's fair to say that we come into this project with less than perfect knowledge. I mean, you take your fiscal rules, which I think is quite an interesting chapter of the Maastricht Treaty. There was sufficient recognition of the fact that a common currency would mean that we are interdependent and therefore fiscal behavior in one country in the north can affect the outcomes for all. And that is true for all countries. So there is the dependencies. And that was the rationale behind the rules in the Maastricht Treaty. But whether this rationale was well executed is, of course, still to this day the subject of discussion. And in fact, there will be a huge debate in 2022. So I think it's fair to say there was some understanding of what matters for the symbols, the euro, as you call it, is a bit more than a symbol, to succeed. But whether we had perfect understanding, I think is still debatable. Mathieu, how do you see the successes of Maastricht and possibly the failures of Maastricht?
Yes, I think that last point that you made, Maria, is really key. But before I go into that, I want to pick up on that point that Amy made about these parallel historical processes that coincide at a certain moment. To give that somewhat more depth, I want to quote former French President Charles de Gaulle, who said to one of his advisors at a certain moment in time, when they were saying to him, these advisors, you are making irrational demands towards other partners. He said, sometimes, your advisors, you have to ask for the moon. You know that you won't get the moon, but you have asked for it. And when circumstances of history develop in a certain way, unforeseen, as they always do, then maybe one time the moon is for sale. And you can get it. And then you were the party that already asked for that in an earlier stage. So the French were already asking for monetary union as of the 1950s, because they saw this was the only way to get some control over German economy, and especially the German Bundesbank and its influence, as Amy just described rightly. François Mitterrand said, you know, the Germans may not have a strong army, but their economy, and especially the D-mark, their currency, is their atomic bomb. They are so powerful due to that strong D-mark currency. So if we want to keep the Germans in check, we have to integrate monetary. It was the next stage of the French strategic agenda. And they were working on that for decades. And the rapport Delors came at a very, very timely moment, because then the wall fall, as Amy just described. And then there was this moment to ask for the moon, ask the Germans to hand over the D-mark to us. And that, I think that is very important to see as a kind of political background to what happened in between the rapport Delors and the Maastricht Treaty. Then, to your question about economic and monetary union, I think the most important here is that we did build in Maastricht and the years after a monetary union, but we didn't build the economic union. So the E of EMU was very much up to the member states to fill in. It was not a European responsibility so much. The Stability and Growth Pact, for instance, was outside of the treaty in the end. It was an appendix to the conclusions of the Council of Ministers. I think that is key to see this, because that was a reflection of the fact that the E was left to the member states to decide. And what happened in the E, in the end, was not that much. So we had a full-fledged monetary union with the European Central Bank, but without the backing up or the foundations in a common economic European policy and politics, I should say. And I think we are now, due to the recovery fund that is set up to counter the problems of the pandemic, of course, due to the recovery fund, we are now, under pressure of the circumstances, filling in the E of EMU, potentially, with the instrument of the recovery funds and fund and all the elements in it. For instance, the SURE program, which is a first step towards socio-economic policies at the European level with own budget, so to say. So not a budget divided over the member states.
But before we go to this, because this is where we are now, and I think I'm going to ask, you know, where we go from there, but let's fill in the period in between, because a lot has happened in that period. And I want us to reflect a little bit on the fact that Maastricht was not the last word to union. It was a platform for many things to happen. Some of them, dare I say, violently. And by violently, I mean that circumstances were such that we had to react. But there was also a lack of appreciation, and I think it's important to reflect that. There was lack of appreciation of certain things and just how close interdependent we were. And I'll give you one example that I always find striking from an economic perspective, how little the profession, if I may call it this way, but all those working on monetary union issues had appreciated or lacked to appreciate the relevance of current accounts in a monetary union. There was a period for which we thought that with a single currency, current accounts, basically the balance between internal and external demand in any country, was just irrelevant in the context of a single currency. And of course, current account imbalances, driven by different reasons, domestic and from abroad, were at the source of the financial crisis in terms of unraveling in the EU. Very quickly, we revised the views about the relevance. And that, of course, comes back to your point, Mathieu, that the economic part of EMU, because that's what this is just as important for MU to be successful.
Maybe to add on this very, very briefly, what also was believed in the setup of the Economic and Monetary Union was that the markets were the partners of the member states. So the markets would kind of naturally pull off this convergence of economic member state economies, so that they would grow towards each other. But in the end, of course, the euro crisis showed that the markets, exactly the markets, were the ones who would point at these current accounts that you are talking about, Maria, and then in that way work as a splitting force in the Eurozone economy as a whole, underlining the fact and also gambling on this fact that there wasn't a real economic union yet. And that that vulnerability really came to the forefront only with the euro crisis, although we already should have known earlier that this was coming.
So architectural advancements as a result of crisis, we have, of course, banking union. At the beginning, you said, Mathieu, that there was a movement of capital. Well, you have good, you need to have better supervision of the movement of capital. Banking union is a way of doing that. We are still trying to create what we call a capital market union, which is one of the non-banking, if you like, movements of capital. We're still not there. What other architectural innovations happened as a result of responses to crisis, but that you think build up on the legacy of Maastricht? Ami?
Yeah, so I think one of the points that that Mathieu also highlighted is this Stability and Growth Pact, which in fact didn't even come in the Maastricht Treaty. If there were some rules in the protocol, they came after, and they were pushed by the Germans, right? The Germans said, now that we see that we're going to have so many member states in it, also member states that they privately did not actually think belonged, because EMU did not right away need to start with the single currency of all these countries, right? It would be if a majority would meet the criteria, otherwise it would automatically start in 1999, stage three, with those countries who met the criteria. And for the longest time, there was big debate about who would meet the criteria, and it was not at all clear.
Absolutely. In the Netherlands, we were gambling on the Italians not being part of it, obviously.
And so did the Germans. And they already had nasty words for the countries in the south that they had not anticipated as necessarily joining the euro. But as all things in life, So the Germans come up with the Stability Pact, and they negotiate and come out of this arrangement. 1995, they have a Stability and Growth Pact. The French put in the word growth because it's not going to be only a Stability Pact. But it was intended to kind of firm up these rules that were not there, right? So this soft business about keeping your monetary macroeconomic policy as a matter of common concern was just insufficient, right? And so this new edifice is built up, and it is supposed to have this discipline. And then as the currency eventually happens with so many countries, even those who were eyewitnesses of that period, they said that it was a leap of faith, right? It was, now we're going to start with so many countries, and we know we don't have the edifice. And the only way to move forward is to solve the problem as it comes along. And that works in good weather times, right? So you have, you know, this problem, that problem, you'll solve it, it'll be fine, right? And interestingly, leaning on these markets means that some of these things are also happening because markets also believe it, because politicians believe it. I think one of the most remarkable graphs that we've seen in long-term interest rates was everybody coming to converge. And then as the crisis erupts in 2007-08, they diverge again, right? So these markets are funny, funny creatures, because no one individual is a market, right? The market is the addition of lots of mass behavior of many actors who are happening at the same time to think about something, right? And so we get this convergence of long-term interest rates throughout the good years, and then we have the divergence of interest rates as long-term interest rates, as we see the crisis unfolding. So back to your question, Maria, I think what was possible in these early days was to focus on those elements that seemed to have immediate support, because you have to still, if you put it in a treaty, you have to still get unanimity, right? So people have to go to their parliaments, parliaments have to sign off on this, everybody's to sign off. It's not like a legislative act with the, you know, this equivalent of this first pillar, the idea that you put a proposal forward and then member states can agree by qualified majority vote. This has to be everybody's degree on it. So to improve things, we would need to do things in the domain of giving money to the EU. Again, this pseudo-federal state that has been created at Maastricht has to be built up a bit. And so when Mathieu is asking about unemployment benefit, this is an automatic stabilizer that in most federations, in most member states, is a way to offset an imbalance in the economy. And then so you don't get so many taxes in one area because there's a bit of a decline. So you give unemployment benefit as an automatic stabilizer. So that did not have the support. And so it was hard to do. And in fact, sure, is not exactly the same as an unemployment benefit for individuals, right? It's more at the higher level. So I think what we're looking at in the next period of time is to identify the areas of incomplete fiscal federalism in the EU that would be suitable to move to the EU level, but still make citizens feel that they can connect to it, right? If I look at Canada, for example, the country I live in now, it has a very decentralized federation. So a lot of these expenses that are made for citizens are made by the lower level. So you can even have high level fiscal federalism with quite a number of things still done by member states. We don't need to become a centralized state if one wants to advance this better integrated fiscal and economic part. But yeah, we will need to think about what needs to happen where and how do we get this done properly, including rules on the banking union, which is not complete, and the capital markets union that you mentioned before.
I guess we can all agree that has been a very steep learning curve. But I'd like to ask the question, because I think we need to sort of look a little bit forward now, where we are now, and sort of think about where we go next. The word federalism is not an easy word in the context of Europe. It's a divisive word. There's those who are very, very much on the context of federalism in whichever form, and there are others that are totally against, invoking most of the times that the citizens don't want it. But in any case, I can assure you that the word federalism is not an easy word in the context of European integration. However, and here comes an interesting observation, and your view on this would be important. At every crisis, and I'm not talking about business cycle type of crisis, I'm talking about once in a lifetime type of events, and we've had two in the past 10 years, once in a lifetime types of events. Parenthesis, if you include the migration crisis, probably three. The solutions that we gave were federalist in nature. By that I mean, we pulled sources together, we came together, we legislated. In the current crisis, we even put funds together to solve the crisis. So it looks like even though the word federalism in Europe is actually a difficult word, there is sufficient recognition of the fact that stronger and together, we are actually a lot more powerful and more effective in solving some of the problems. Where does that leave us now? And in particular, where will we go in the future? I'll start with you, Mathieu.
Yeah, this is a crucial thing. So I think if we look at the economic and monetary union, we can say that solidarity was there and also in the end played out, but in a very devastating way in terms of trust between the member states. So we still have to cope with that.
Mathieu, is solidarity a good way, a solid basis for a monetary union?
Yeah, so the solidarity now was hidden in the balance sheet of the European Central Bank. That was where it was. And the key problem with that solidarity is that it's not legitimized democratically. That is a source of the problems that many ordinary Europeans have with the current state of affairs in the South, but also in the North for different reasons. That they feel that they were not recognized by their democracies in taking those key political decisions that have to be democratically legitimized in a proper democracy. They were not part of it. It was done through the ECB, and it was hidden in the balance sheets of the ECB. Now, due to the pandemic, this isn't possible anymore. So the political decision that was hidden in the ECB, so to say, is now coming as a new question of solidarity in the pandemic. And now the decision, and I think it was summarized quite straightforward by Wolfgang Schäuble when the talk was about the Franco-German recovery fund, the initial idea that was scaled up to the EU recovery fund months later. But in the early months of 2020, the early days of the pandemic, Wolfgang Schäuble said, if we now do the same thing as we did in the euro crisis, we will again do loans with austerity kind of conditionality, we will give the countries stones instead of bread, the countries that need help. And this is unfair because this is a pandemic and doesn't have anything to do with your economic affairs. Domestically, you were hit by a global phenomenon. So we have to do it the other way around. Start first with the democratic, legitimized solidarity. And that means, in fact, filling the E of EMU. That means making proper solidarity choices and also put that to your democracies at the national level in terms of real money and not something hidden in the technocratic realm of the ECB. And I think that is a major step forward. It's a major step forward, but it's also a test, as you correctly underlined, Maria. Is this solidarity real? Do we have enough of it to make the next step? And that is a critical political test. It's a political test in essence. This is not about economics. This is about getting your constituencies nationally behind a solidarity challenge that you have to face due to the circumstances and due to the project you're in together. And if that test fails, then European integration will be about disintegration more than about integration.
I think it's an important point, actually. The economic response to the pandemic crisis, which was, I totally agree with the fact that it was the culmination of 20 years of learning curve, a very steep learning curve. While it might have been motivated from a pandemic, a health crisis, which of course required a humanitarian approach to it, the economic response to it was very question mark. And that's my question. The economic response to the pandemic crisis, was that the result of thinking about how can we best solidarize to those who are being affected? Or was this good economics in an environment where we believe that we're integrated economically?
So let me jump in because I've written about this myself. And I think Mathieu says what it was like in the early spring. And eventually we came to the council that had to deal with this again as a group, like not two countries can decide this. It had to be decided by a lot. And there was also a voice, in fact, of the Dutch and others that were not as enthusiastic to just kind of hand over money to others. And not because they didn't have the solidarity to give it, but they just were thinking steps ahead. They were going like, okay, this is potentially path dependent. This could drag on for much longer. If we now, if we don't ask for the moon, to use the other comparison, if we don't set clear rules on how we want to do this moving forward, we may live to regret this. We may not be able to explain this to our citizens. Why are we giving money to the Italians that haven't, you know, taken care of their public debt for years and years and years, and who got into the euro when they really shouldn't have, according to the rules, because the rules said they had to go to 60%. They were still above 100% of their debt in terms of GDP. So, I mean, there are a lot of things that are playing in the background. So I think the solidarity, the citizens have a lot of solidarity. We've seen research showing this, that even before the pandemic, citizens felt that a number of these areas should be at the EU level. I think where we're now moving to is a period where the whole sense of globalization is moving in a very different direction. So globalization in the last 2-3 decades was all about the entire globe. And so if a company wanted to build things in China and then sell it in the United States with some kind of a, you know, firm in the Philippines that does the marketing for you, everybody was happy. And then as things emerge, we've had, you know, Donald Trump, we've had the corona crisis, we have the rise of China. All of these questions about where are we and where should we be going are being rethought. Citizens have also complained about free trade agreements, right? Who could complain about free trade agreements? 20 years ago, free trade was the way to advance the markets, was a way to advance specialization of production. And now citizens complain about the environmental and the labor standards in other countries when you have trading products. So I think as we move towards this next period, we're going to ask ourselves the question, exactly what is the scope and scale of what we're doing? And in that case, the European Union might be a smaller scale globe in which you can still govern some things, but also keep it sufficiently close to home that you can sort of more or less see the tentacles of where it's going. Because I don't think that the alternative to not liking what the EU is doing is nationalism and sort of the economy in one country of whatever Albania was doing in the 1960s, but it is actually still working together. It's the question of who has the responsibility for what type of policy and what is the appropriate scale. And so the EU has to jump into this sort of vacuum that's emerging as globalization is contracting a little bit, but not a belief that you can do it in one country. To fight cybercrime, you're not going to do that in one country. If there's going to be a war in the Koreas, you're not going to solve that in one country. If there's going to be climate solutions, you're not going to solve that in one country. So many of the really big issues that we face, including the migration crisis, the one that you sort of carefully put it as a crisis of the EU or not, that's a global crisis. People come from all over the world to the places where they think they can have a better life because of war, because of famine, because of economic disparity and climate change, right? So what is it that the EU wants to do? It needs to find the appropriate level for the kind of problems and decide what it can deliver its citizens. And the people who are holding on to the power are those who have a lot of it now, national parliaments, national governments. And they have the hardest time. They are the Bundesbank of 1992 that had to decide that they were the powerful actor. And in order to go to a better place, they actually need to give some of it up. And that is very difficult for a national politician. They are not, their underbelly is not, let's give power away to somebody else. Their underbelly is, I want to get my power right now, I want to keep it, and I'm going to tell the citizens I am the strong person. And we've seen that happening in Boris Johnson, in other places in the world, where just having my power is a great place to be.
Can I, interesting, if I may kind of circle it back to Maastricht, one of the ambitions in Maastricht at the set out was very much, there was talk about the issue of defense and security. But unlike economics, with all its hips and bounds, which we have actually advances. On the issue of defense and security, we've made very little, very progress. And actually, I'm raising this because today, perhaps we are seeing the fruits of that lack of progress. Is this something that this, you know, is very much in the Commission agenda, something to advance? It is very much in the French presidency, which is currently the president of the European Council. But is security and union something that perhaps in the next 30 years we can build on?
Yes, I think so. But there is also an underestimation of one of an instrument that the EU has that is very, very powerful in geopolitics, actually, and that is enlargement. And that came to the European Union in a sphere of the denial of geopolitics, in a sphere of we are moving beyond realpolitik and intimidation, and this is peaceful, soft power, kind of, you know, making the world better. Now it is perceived by others already for years as a geopolitical instrument, and it's now kind of confronting the European Union in the present day crises, especially with Russia. And I think there is now a momentum to move on this dossier for the first time since the 1950s, actually, because there is a French president. If he will be re-elected, he's full force in favor of moving on this dimension with European integration. I don't know exactly in what way, but the direction is clear. There is a European Commission which very much underlines this ambition and also aligns it with its own agenda to really make work of the second pillar of the Maastricht Treaty, so to say. But what we need here, and this, I think Amy raised that point, and I think it's the crucial one, what we need here is that national governments start to shoulder explicitly and also in a more complete narrative to their national publics the European integration process. And that is a big difference with the Maastricht moment. Then there was this willingness, this political willingness of national governments to carry this together, this enormous leap. That now is lacking, that common feeling of responsibility that you explain to your national public why this is important and why it is crucial to tackle climate change, to tackle cybersecurity, to face Russia. And I think that is the crucial thing that we are missing at the moment. But there are some lights at the horizon. For instance, the new German government, which in the coalition agreement is very clear about the importance of European integration as an integral part of German domestic politics and German interests. The French government under Macron, but we have to wait what the elections will bring. But if he can continue, that will be an enormous boost for this agenda, exactly, because he was the first one in the last years who proved that with this more complete story about the importance of European integration, you can actually win national elections. And I think that is a very important example. It was a very important example for younger generations. It was a very important antidote to Brexit. And it now has to be fleshed out more in a kind of common responsibility of the member states who want to move forward to do this effort in the national arenas of democracy to tell the complete story that national interest in this Europe of European integration cannot go without investing in that Europe of European integration. It's not for free.
That's actually very well put. Very well put, Mathieu. This idea, how to make this practice, actually. We're coming close to the end of the time, and although this is a fascinating discussion, I think we need to come to a close. I'm going to ask you to look into your magic ball, and we've had 30 years before us. Where do you think the edifice European Union is going to be in 30 years from now? And I know it's very difficult to disentangle where you think it's going to be to where you want it to be, but if you were to take a shot, do you think we're going to be more integrated and more successful, or do you think be more integrated but less successful, or perhaps less integrated? Amy?
Yeah, so I think integration is still the move forward. I take courage out of the conference on the future of Europe, where we're trying also to build more the citizens together that we really need. Important developments have been made in that context, and Mathieu also started off talking about citizens being disgruntled or not knowing what's going on. And I think the next step is to have the lived experience, to understand why this level of integration, why this level of government is useful and helpful. And as long as the citizens don't understand, don't feel connected, don't have a sense of where this is all going, it would be difficult to move it forward. But I'm confident that we see this, and we want to make ways in which everybody feels this connection and appreciates that this level is another level that helps us tackle these issues that are bigger than those of a nation state, and that together we're stronger than apart.
Mathieu, do you share that optimism?
Yeah, to a certain extent I do. I think, to come back to your question, I think 30 years from now, the EU will be more and less integrated, but stronger as a force in international relations. I explain what I mean. So in 1994, a couple of years after the Maastricht Treaty was signed, and a year after the Maastricht Treaty started functioning, there was this Schäuble-Lamers-Papier, which is famous in Germany. Wolfgang Schäuble and Karl Lamers, two CDU politicians, put together a document in which they predicted that there were three main challenges for the Europe of European integration after the signing of the Maastricht Treaty and the end of the Cold War. And that were the external borders, which were unclear and unprotected, and would be very unprotected after the Cold War, obviously. Migration, which obviously is a global phenomenon, as you explained already, Maria, and would come to the EU one way or the other. And economic and monetary union. Those three challenges, the conclusion they drew was, we have to move forward swiftly in all three domains, but we cannot do this with an enlarged European Union. We need example setters, forerunners, a group of countries that can take the lead so that others can see that example and then decide, do we want to be part of that deeper integration on all these three domains or not? And I think that is what we will see. We will see the Europe of the Eurozone with the recovery fund as an enormous important catalysator, as a kind of a forerunning group within the European Union without splitting it up. So as a kind of beacon, so to say, for others that you can be inspired by or can neglect without exiting the European Union as such. And with its more variety, I think it's very important, because another crucial benefit of this will be that it is no longer up to the brakeman to define what is possible within European integration. But at this moment, these are the conservative forces, those who don't want to go that far or even want to go back in European integration, that to a very important extent determine the agenda of what is possible. It's the lowest common denominator kind of logic. What we need is to turn this logic around. And the only way to do that, I agree with the Schäuble-Lamers paper of 1994, is to have these forerunner groups and of European integration of different paces, so to say.
The problems that we will face and we are facing today and in the next 30 years, and I'm really thinking of climate here more than anything else, but also the pandemic falls in the category, they really are bigger than ourselves. The global forces are, political forces are moving, the supremacy of nations is moving, our relationship as nation states are moving into new normals. And it's very difficult to imagine that Europe, European countries individually and collectively can do better alone. But I think that is something for historians like you to examine, and we can discuss this along in another occasion. But I'm afraid we are coming to an end now. There will be, however, a follow-up in a conference that Maastricht University is organizing on the 26th and the 27th of September. Again, EURAT 30, lessons learned and ways forward. And I'm hoping that we will have a little bit more time then to discuss some of these things more in detail. In the meantime, thank you so much for giving us your perspective. It has been an absolutely fascinating discussion. For that, I am very grateful. And thank you to our listeners for taking the time to join us today. Thank you for the moment and hope to see you in another event. Bye-bye.